everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things of life. You can listen to us on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm great.
I would like to take our first little segment this morning, and we're going to go talk with Tracy McMillan, who wrote a wonderful book on going undercover in the food industry. But I'd like to talk about something maybe not even food-related, because Tracy's book talks about families and society in general, and, you know, we can delve a little bit out of food. I want to talk about an article that I read in the Star-Ledger, a guy named Carmen Jura, who wrote this article on camping, summer camps in the 21st century. As we come up to camping season, I know that you have four children of your own. You're mired in a world of children, little rugrats running everywhere.
I went to a sleepaway camp a couple of years when I was a kid. Loved it.
I was much too much of a wimp to go to a sleepaway camp. Day really? Camp, and they had to send me home.
Loved it. I think that maybe the counselors couldn't couldn't deal with
a couple of them quit after your
24 hours a day of Francis Schott.
I thought you were going to say the counselors quit after you went away for sleepaway camp. How long were you gone?
2 weeks. And 2 weeks, two different times.
And in those two-week periods, how often did you talk to your mom on the phone?
Zero.
How often did she come and visit you?
Zero.
How often did you text her?
Zero.
Same
number. Zero. See you in 2 weeks, Mom.
How did your mom like that?
I think they went away. They never told us, but I'm sure that they went away and did something fun.
How did you like that?
It was awesome. There was a sense of freedom as a 10-year-old the first time I went. I was 10 years old, although my brother was at the same camp, but I don't think we crossed paths three times.
Except for the couple of times he found you and beat you.
But, 10 years old, freedom, new people, interesting, fun-filled days.
And being away from your mother for 2 weeks, wasn't that traumatic? Wasn't it awful? And didn't you cry? Wasn't it terrible?
It was one of the great experiences of my life.
Right. Okay, so 21st.
Well, up to 10. It was one of the great experiences of my life up to 10.
21st century camping.
Until Elvis died. It was very sad.
He was not. You weren't into Elvis.
Elvis died while I was at camp.
Oh, did he really?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was at sleepaway camp and Elvis died.
My beef had never gone to camp. Never mind. So, article on 21st century camping I find really disturbing. I'll read a little from the article. Summer camp has always been an electronics-free zone. Plugged-in campers need not apply, but that doesn't mean the camps don't use technology to their advantage, or rather to a parent's benefit. An increasing number of camps have embraced posting daily photos online for parents to see their children swimming, canoeing, toasting marshmallows, and to see them in action.
Don't we see them in action every day? They're our children.
Well, that's why I sent them to camp. The web department at Jefferson Lakes Day Camp in Sussex County was once a one-person operation. That's 10 years ago, said owner Jane Kagan. Today, there is a staff of seven, and all they do every day is go around, snap, 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 smile with the camera, smile with the camera, canoeing, smile with the camera, stop roasting marshmallows, smile with the camera, stop while you're swimming, smile for the camera.
Two different things I want to say here. One, I don't have any problem with people walking around taking pictures of the campers and camping.
Well, authorized people anyway. Sorry.
Yes, that was what I meant. You know, and maybe creating a collage or a collection of pictures. But we need to be able to separate from our children for periods of time and let them have that sense of freedom. We are overly connected.
And they need to separate from you.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean. They need to. We're overly connected. We are overly tied together. You text your mom 40 times from college in the first 2 weeks you're there. You know, I went away to college. I called my mom. I said, I'm good. I'm here. I'm settled in. See you Thanksgiving.
Yes, serve me some turkey at Thanksgiving.
And it made me a better and more independent human being.
And you know what? That's what I see in a lot of young people today who are 18 or 19 and in college and may apply for a first job with us. They are just like totally useless. I mean, hobbled by this connection.
Occasionally, and this still happens, somebody's dad will call me and say, yeah, she can't work that day. We're going to grandma's house.
Yeah, I don't react very well to that.
You know, your dad called me. because you couldn't call me. And I just, you know, I get family obligations, and I get all the different parts of life that come with being part of a family, obviously.
You're fired. Okay. And the answer is, oh, that's cool. Do me a favor. Tell your little darling they're fired.
Yeah.
How dare you? I can you imagine being 18 and allowing your parent to call your boss?
I would have gone crazy if my dad or mom had called my boss when I was 18 or 19.
And all you parents that are out there doing that kind of stuff, you are crazy.
Or 22 years old or 23 years old.
We have had parents call us of people in their 20s, and I'm thinking, are you? And to the credit of the person that I'm thinking of most recently, the parent said, listen, please don't tell my daughter that I called. Mm-hmm. And I thought, dude, I'm not going to tell her that you called because I'm not going to talk to you. Because this is crazy. It's like, oh, well, you don't understand, and they're trying very hard. And I thought, this conversation shows me that, you know, if this was okay with your daughter, it would be an indication that she shouldn't be working here. She should be.
You know, and this is a true story. I felt a little weird. My daughter had not typed she's a freshman in high school. Had not typed a document for homework, and got some points knocked off for it, and felt weird about talking to the teacher. So I sent the teacher an email and said, hey, I just want to make you aware of our living situation. Our house was flooded. We don't have a computer. She had no way to type this document. Can you just, you know, keep your eyes out, you know, for you know, anything that...
The river ran through my house.
You know, anything that might... You know, go wrong here. If you can just keep an eye out, and I felt weird doing that. She's in ninth grade,
right? Right.
Okay,
totally appropriate though.
14 years old, and I felt weird contacting a teacher on her behest because I was like, she's right at that age where she really should be taking care of these things herself.
At 16, 17, she should be.
Absolutely.
And that's not to say that if at 16, 17, or 14, 15, they go through the proper channels and they are treated in an unacceptable way, then a parent, of course, steps in. But you're a legal adult. You've got a job. And well, anyway, the other thing is you want them to be able to go on their own and deal with some issues
you want
and some
them
problems.
To, you know, better to learn at summer camp when there are counselors and nurses and other people there and a support crew on how to leave the nest than to do it when they're 21 years old and live in their first apartment by themselves and say, you know, I can't balance a checkbook or buy groceries.
Well, and to have even just the emotional sense of identity of themselves as
a being
apart from
you. But that's what I'm talking about I physically can't do it, but I can't do it because there's no one here to hold my hand through it.
Well, so here's how this works, and this is evidently going on at summer camps across America. You get your child at camp, you click on, and the first thing, if you sign in, you know, they give you a sign in, and the first thing that pops up is a picture of your kid from that day doing something fun. That's really but just think about the whole summer camp. This summer camp, they have seven people walking around saying, "Okay, smile for the camera. Okay, stop." And
well, it reminds me, and you and I have both been to weddings like this, and Francis and I obviously have been to weddings together because we share the same friends.
Yeah,
where you'll go to a wedding, and the focus of the wedding will be
the pictures,
the book will be the album that comes after the wedding. And not the wedding.
Right. Remember this day where we all posed for pictures.
Remember this day where we literally spent 80% of it
posing for pictures. And not
and
really
none
having
of
a good
it
time.
Really enjoying the, right. the
not
the
really
events.
Having a good time. Yeah. I'm way against that. I really well, it's also one of the reasons I have so few pictures of you know, it's funny, I have more pictures now in my life that there's a camera on my phone and everybody has a camera on their phone. You say, oh, you know what, let's take a picture of this. Mm-hmm. And it's not the focus of everything. But this whole, like, take a picture for your mom and dad, and you're constantly – the idea is to go away and not think about your mom and dad
right, exactly.
every
you
day.
Right, exactly. You have this great adventure in front of you. Bask in the adventure.
Right. And
bask
and,
in the adventure.
Yeah, you know, it's just mamby-pamby. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment talking with Tracy McMillan about her new book. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. And remember, you can download our podcast on iTunes. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And our guest today is Tracy McMillan. Tracy has taken time out of her life to do a little bit of investigative journalism. She worked in a Walmart and Applebee's and farm fields picking peaches, grapes, onions, and garlic. And then she wrote a book about it called The American Way of Eating, Undercover in all those places.
Hey, Tracy, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys, thanks so much for having me.
What an interesting book, and what a lot of really backbreaking research that you did for this thing. What inspired you to go undercover in all of these places? What was the unifying theme? What was the inspiration that sent you to do all the work for this book?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a couple of things that led me to go do this book where I was undercover in all the different food systems. So a big part of it was that I'm from a working-class background in the Midwest, and I really wanted to have a conversation about food that made sense for the folks I grew up with and the folks I covered as a poverty reporter in New York City. And as far as going undercover, it was a mix of wanting to be able to tell a good and an honest story. So that meant, you know, going and living and eating off the wages of the folks who make our food. But I also really wanted to go undercover just because, you know, companies, generally speaking, don't treat journalists the same way that they treat their workers. And I wanted to get a sense of the internal logic without, you know, a press person sort of looking over my shoulder and trying to tell me what
they
think.
You see, we operate restaurants, but we also get press passes to a lot of stuff. And I like the champagne and caviar they get for free. I'm about the press lounge. You know what I mean? It doesn't make for good journalism unless, well, I write about champagne and caviar. So, you know, this is a different end of the food spectrum you're talking about.
But I have to say, there's a great amount of respect, and I certainly think that it lends a lot of credence to your book that you immersed yourself in this, you know, kind of a la Michael Ruhlman, you know, some of the books he's written about food and chefs and things like that. You spent the time to really be part of the story that you were writing about, not just report on something from afar, which is, I think, you know, how most stories are told and how most stories are written. In this way, I think it's a much more real and a much truer story, and you know we can understand it better. We see the inner workings.
How long did this take you? This project, the research for this project.
Sure. So from sort of sitting down and pitching with publishers, the publication was about 3 years. The actual undercover reporting took just over 1 year. So in each job, I was supposed to be there for 2 months at a time. So I ended up doing really about 3 months in farm work because there's some dead time in there when I'm looking for work or figuring my, you know, sort of my schedule out. And then I spent really about 4 months total looking for and getting work at different Walmarts because I wanted to make sure I got some work in the produce section. And then it really was just about 9 weeks of actual work for the Applebee's section. You know, and once I finished all of that, I had to sit down, write the narrative, and then double back and do a lot of the policy and economics reporting after that.
So does it bother you that making under minimum wage as a farm worker, that you, when you realize that you probably are making it as a writer as well?
Well, I made that observation to a number of folks who were helping me read the manuscript, and they all said, you know, I don't know if you need to complain about that. And I said, well, I know it's more flexible as a writer, but, you know, I really am not doing any better, you know, economically as a writer than certainly when I was working at Applebee's or Walmart.
I just have to share with you something, and this is where I pin my hopes. I think this would make a great frickin' movie.
I concur. The screenplay, we'll get right to work on the screenplay for you.
Yeah. Well, it was funny. There was there were some comments, you know, online about the book, and somebody was actually making fun of the book, but they had this fabulous line about, well, who would be playing them in the movies? And someone said, oh, that girl in the kitchen with her, that'll be Queen Latifah. And then Tracy will be played by Anne Hathaway.
Yeah, and then you're going to get sued by Walmart, Applebee's, and the Farm Association of America. That's a
right.
Sad thing about this. So what was the hardest job you did? And what was and tell us about your experience. Was picking in the field, was that the hardest?
Well, physically picking in the field was definitely the hardest. My first day, I was only able to pick about 7 or 8 buckets of garlic. So these are construction buckets, you know, those 5-gallon things they sell at Home Depot.
That's basically one day's marinara sauce in Catherine Lombardi in our restaurant. But and you get paid by the piece, right?
Right. You get paid $1.60 for each bucket. And where I was working in the field, they really just pay you by piece. My first day, I did have some of my coworkers donate garlic to me, which is sort of a mixture of flirtation and pity. And, you know, that brought my total up to 10. So I picked, you know, 10 buckets for the first day, and that meant I made $16 for a nine-hour day.
Oh, my God. So what is does a picker who, I mean, let's face it, you probably suck at picking garlic.
Right,
but
yeah.
What is somebody who is good at picking garlic, how much can they bring in a day, backbreaking it, though it is?
Yeah, the most anybody I worked with could pick was an average of 4 buckets an hour. To reach minimum wage for an eight-hour day, you need to pick 5 an hour. Most folks I worked with were more picking about 3 to 3.5 an hour.
So I guess what most of us who live in America, when we read this and talk to you about it, how did they get away with that? I don't understand how
farm workers
that happens.
You don't have to pay minimum wage for farm work.
No, you do.
You do.
I
you?
Mean, for the most part, there are some exceptions around piece rate, depending on which state you're in, because farm workers are exempt from most federal labor protections at the federal level, so it's got to be legislated at the state level.
But you're in California, where there is
legislation. California, which has actually really good regulations on the books around farm labor. It's just that it's not really enforced, for the most part, by the Labor Department. They also rely in California, as do most labor departments, on complaints. And most of the folks I worked with were undocumented, right? So they didn't really want to complain and risk losing employment altogether.
Mm. Have you heard from the Department of Agriculture of California since you wrote this a couple months ago?
I haven't really heard from any institutions whatsoever since the book came out. We haven't done any formal outreach to government in California yet. That's something we're planning to do later this spring, early summer.
That's because you are what they call in the non-agricultural world right now a hot potato. So everyone in the department is saying, oh, God, I hope it is not my extension that rings when she calls.
Right. Well, there's actually a new labor commissioner in position in California named Julie Sue, who's actually got a history in doing advocacy work with garment workers, which, you know, one of the primary forms of labor organization in that field is subcontracting, which is what I was working for. So I was working for a labor contractor named El Bajio, which then was picking the garlic in turn for Christopher Ranch and the Garlic Company, which are the companies, you know, that you'd see at the store. So Commissioner Sue is actually really thoughtful about wanting to enforce the laws that they have on the books. You know, we'll see what she's able to do. So I anticipate having a fairly nice conversation with her.
You know, I read your book, and we believe in, obviously, social justice, as everyone should believe in social justice, that people need to be able to eat, that, you know, the opportunity to make a wage that you can feed yourself on is really central to the foundation of any civilization. But, you know, in reading your book, I sort of was struck by the, you know, just that I had empathy for a lot of people all the way up the chain, because if you're the labor contractor, or you're the guy running the crew, or you're the guy right above him, if you're in a world where the government is not enforcing the minimum wage that exists and not enforcing the laws that exist, well, then your partner is going to pay, your competition is going to pay a little bit less than minimum wage and charge a little bit less, and he's going to get the job and you're not.
Maybe charge half. Maybe
right.
Be able to charge half of what you charge.
So where I feel, you know, I just felt empathy all along the pit that everyone seems to be stuck in, which is if we don't enforce a floor, then people will race to the bottom. And there are people desperate enough, undocumented people, and, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not against undocumented people, because if we kick out all the undocumented people, you'll have other people on the floor, you know. And if
right.
you think that American citizens are going to take this job,
or you won't have any garlic,
right? Right, exactly.
You'll have other people on the floor, you won't have any garlic.
But you know, maybe that's the thing. Maybe the garlic needs to cost 50% more than garlic costs. But you know, I mean, you're talking about the total labor contribution. If you're talking about a 5-gallon bucket, gets you what, $9? You said
no, $1.60.
I'm sorry, $1.60. So what is that? A tenth of a penny per head of garlic? A hundredth of a penny per head of garlic goes to the farm labor. Maybe we make it 4/100ths of a penny, 6/100ths of a penny, and our garlic prices go up 4%. It's a systemic problem that needs a systemic answer. And what you do in your book, which I think is great, is you don't villainize the boss. You don't villainize the next level up.
You mean vilify.
That doesn't villainize work. Did I make up a word? Everybody knew what I meant. Shakespeare did it. So, I mean, what's your perspective on that?
Shakespeare.
That's true, I'm not. But your book points about a whole systemic problem that needs, intervention on a large level. It's not like there's one bad apple out there, you know? I mean, what's your perspective on that?
Right, yeah, well, I think bringing up this concept of a floor is really important. And the problem is everyone can race to the bottom if there's no enforcement whatsoever of laws. And it's been really interesting because I talk a lot to growers about sort of the problems with labor, and every single grower, and I'm not exaggerating here, every grower I've ever talked to says, I don't know how anybody could ever cheat like that. We are so overregulated. Nobody would ever do that. And it really calls into question just how much these folks know about what's going on in their fields, because I've talked to other garlic producers, nobody that I had worked for, but other folks, you know, who run garlic fields, and they tell me, like, these are the guys at the companies that are buying and selling the garlic, and they tell me, you know, a good worker in 6 hours, he can pick 100 buckets, and that's just not human.
Yeah.
Right? That's just not possible. And what's happening, right, the contractor, right, is under all this competitive pressure to provide as cheap of labor as possible, and so... And they bid against each other, right? So then they go to the company and they say, oh, we can do it this way. And because they're doctoring the actual accounting files, right, and saying, oh, $16 divided by minimum wage of 8, that's 2 hours, right, which is what my paychecks would say, you know, they can go to the grower and say, see, look, everybody got minimum wage. And that's so, what I heard from everyone I talked to.
So you work, but you work more than 2 hours. So you're,
yeah, I worked 8 or 9, as did all of my coworkers. And what was happening, right, is somewhere between the field and the paycheck, somebody did the math to say, well, this is what they earned by piece. If we'd paid the minimum wage, how many hours would that have equaled? Right.
Oh,
so you get paid for your piece rate, but your hours are changed so that in the accounting books it looks like everyone is making minimum wage.
So talk to us about your experience in the fields and the people you met and how people eke out an existence. Talk to us about that. Give us a little of the flavor of the book.
I'm going to tell you, I thought the best parts of the book were when you talked about the people after hours, when you talked about the places that you lived and how you lived. I thought that was the most colorful parts of the book.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I tried to do my friends and colleagues justice, so I'm glad that came across well. I mean, in working in the fields, you know, I think there's this myth that, you know, the people who are really poor have just figured out some magical way to get by with not much money, and there's no magic to it, right? They just economize in ways that, you know, most Americans take for granted that they're never going to have to do. So with farm workers, you know, in the Salinas Valley, I was living in a small two-bedroom house with about 16 or 17 other people. And so there was a family of 7 in the biggest bedroom. There was a family of 4 in a small bedroom. I was renting sort of a cubby with a bed off the living room. And then there were 4 or 5 guys living in the garage and a shed built off the garage. So for me, that was – and, it, you know, it sort of worked out okay. Nobody had too much difficulty with that. But, you know, I befriended the oldest daughter of the family who was renting the house. So this is the family of 7. And tried to help her a little bit with English, but after a while I realized she wasn't going to be going to school. She was 14. She'd come up that February from Oaxaca. She'd made the desert crossing with her dad. And she had basically been brought up to do domestic labor in the house to make it easier for her parents to go and work in the field. So her parents and her older brother, you know, were picking peas for a living. And then she was making, you know, all the homemade tortillas and these wonderful soups and stews and moles and all this food, you know. And so initially when I got to the house, I thought, oh, this is amazing. I'm getting this wonderful, you know, Mexican food. It's homemade. It's so great. And, you know, it stopped being so exciting when I realized, you know, this is only happening because this girl isn't going to school, right? She cooks and she cleans and she keeps the house clean enough with that many people and watches all of the kids. At the same time, you know, those parents were doing the best that they could and the best that they knew how for their kids. And, you know, all the other kids were going to school. It's just that, you know, they sort of made this decision, you know, for us to keep doing the economic work here in the U.S., we're going to have someone do the housework.
Somebody's going to have to say, oh, my, what a horrible choice to have to make. So, and you talk a little about your various landlords who give us some color about that. Give us some background on your landlords that you encountered.
Sure. Well, I had a couple of real interesting ones. One in farm work actually was this older woman, probably in her 40s, early 50s, who really took to me as being a daughter. And she's a very heavyset woman, and she'd been living in the U.S. for about 15 or 20 years. No, much longer than that. She'd been here for a really long time. And she was just this amazing storyteller, right? So she regaled, like, a group of us on the porch with, you know, we're sitting around with beers and fruit, and she's talking about almost crashing in a plane crash at some point in Mexico. And she was incredibly kind with me, But I was really reliant a lot on her generosity with me because, you know, she had a whole crew of workers that lived in her backyard in the little house that had been built back there called a casita. And she was renting them rooms, and she was their ride to work, and she was their boss. And so it was this situation where I really appreciated both how kind she was to me and also that I didn't have to rely only on her kindness, right? And then in Michigan, I had this wonderful landlady who was incredibly charming and sweet and nobody that anyone would ever think of as a foodie if you just looked at her, right? She was real heavy, hair kind of sloppy, wearing, like, sweatshirts and jeans. But, you know, she was just completely obsessed with food. And so she would come by the house to fix something. She'd say, oh, you're baking bread? Well, there's just no reason for you to buy those packets, honey. Those are so expensive. I buy yeast in bulk to bake all my bread at home. Let me just bring you a jar of yeast.
You know, one of the things that a recurring theme and goes into what you're talking about here is how people really did come together. And it wasn't like the exploitation person to person on you know, this level of the market. I think that's where a lot of people would say, oh, the landlords, oh, the crew chief, oh, the. But that wasn't always the case.
No, I mean, I think people, generally speaking, are trying to get by as best they can when they need to sort of bend the rules or be unfair to someone for themselves to get by. Sometimes they'll do that, and sometimes they won't. And mostly people are incredibly kind. You know, I do need to be honest, right? Like, I'm a young-looking white woman, and my story, right, in talking to folks was, you know, I'm having a lot of problems right now. I don't want to talk about it. I'm just getting my stuff back together. You know, and sort of this narrative of, like, I'm starting over. I've had a rough time. And there's something about that that's very powerful for people in terms of wanting to help me. I'm also,
yeah,
just generally speaking, a very open person. And, you know, my family struggled a lot when I was growing up. And, you know, I was honest about those struggles with people. I didn't invent a different background or anything like that. It, you know, I just left out the part about being a journalist.
You know, one of the things that I found in owning my own restaurant and starting it from nothing and, you know, having 50 of my friends and 20 other people who I would consider at the time just acquaintances come and help us build the restaurant when it was time to build the restaurant. One of the things you realize is that most people really do want to do something to help. They do, you know, people are searching for that, you know, having recently my house flooded and, you know, we were a mess and people came out of the woodwork to do what they could do and help in a way that you know, people feel good about helping other people. I think that's a basic human, you know, principle that certain people have forgotten, but the majority of us live with.
But see how I see that translating in your book is, you know, it seems that there are a lot of people trying to do the right thing, trying to be their brother's keeper, trying to be fair. But it's almost it's like the system is rigged against. It's not the system. The system is set up in such a way that they're not getting out. That you might make some marginal gains, but you're not going to get out. I mean, was that your experience as well?
Yeah, I definitely came to sort of appreciate Barbara Ehrenreich's observation in Nickel and Dime that, you know, as I think she's got a great line, something along the lines of, you know, as with physics, you know, your starting condition is everything, right? And where you start out determines a lot about where you end up. And I was just talking with some folks about this today in Detroit, and, you know, my family never had a ton of money, but we've been here a really long time. So my family has accumulated some degree of capital and stability and things like that where I can't even fathom, you know, how the families I was friends with in California, right, are necessarily going to move out because, you know, you need some savings, you need some stability in order to do things like go to college or, you know, make investments in your future. You know, the idea of something paying off in the future doesn't make sense for a lot of folks who are really broke because they don't have anything to make an investment with, right?
Well, and you say starting position, even the knowledge of how to invest things and the cultural things that we get. You know, you said yourself, a lot of people maybe took even a special interest in you, and you said, you know, you're a young-looking white woman. I've seen your picture on your book cover. You're an attractive, young-looking white woman who has an education, is well-spoken, you can write. I think that maybe one of the things they saw in trying to help you out was here was somebody who maybe could get out because you're legal, you have documentation, you can work. But what does that 14-year-old have who's not legal if she did go to school?
And now does, right, now has no education,
yeah,
as well.
I mean,
right, although I will point out I do not sound particularly bright in Spanish,
yeah,
which I think also really helped me, you know, because You know, I talk a lot. It's a lot harder for me to get myself in trouble when I'm stuck with, you know, mostly just the present tense.
Yeah,
yeah. And a very limited vocabulary. So there's a degree to which they might have thought I wasn't that bright after all.
I got it. That is genius, ingenious undercover work you did there. Hey, we're talking with Tracy McMillan about her book, The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. You can find out more about her book at RestaurantGuysRadio.com, and we'll be back in just a moment, so please do stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com, and, of course, you can download our podcast on iTunes.
Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Tracy McMillan about her excellent book, The American Way of Eating, a result of undercover journalism at several stores, fields, restaurants. We've been talking about fields a lot. Let's move to Walmart. You worked in a couple of different Walmarts. Is that true?
Yeah. So when I started the project, I really wanted to get a sense of how healthy food works in the U.S. So we talk a lot about there being too much corn and soy and processed food. And I said, well, I don't really know anything about how we grow healthy foods. Maybe, you know, it'd be helpful to learn about that. And distribution's a really important part of that. So I wanted to go and work at a Walmart in the produce section. And just, you know, what happened is I've spent most of my life in independent media or sort of small, scrappy jobs. I don't have a lot of experience in corporate America. So I had this sort of silly idea in my head that, you know, when in my interview at Walmart, they said, oh, well, get in on the ground floor and you can move around, that, you know, I would be able to transfer positions in the matter of a couple of weeks because they brought me in to stock in the grocery section. And so it just ended up being that, you know, I waited a couple of weeks, so I didn't want to look like a jerk. And they said, hey, what about transferring? And they said, oh, how about 6 months? And so, you know, I spent a little over a month at a Walmart outside of Kalamazoo, Michigan, which is on the west side of the state, a very agricultural part. And Michigan actually has a lot of very diverse agriculture. And then I ended up leaving and coming back to Michigan and working at a Walmart outside of Detroit, and in that time I sort of held out for a job in produce.
So tell us about your experiences at Walmart and what insights you gleaned from your time working overnight at Walmart and in America's, you know, largest grocery distributor.
Sure. So one thing which seems very obvious in hindsight is that there's a lot of human labor still involved in supermarkets. You know, if you had asked me how I thought stuff got onto the shelves at Walmart, you know, if I'd really been honest, I would have said, well, it just gets there, or it's a robot, right? But actually, everything on the shelves at Walmart, right, has been moved there by a human, and it's been priced by a human. So it was interesting. A lot of the women I worked with had carpal tunnel problems, right, because they'd been working the pricing guns so much. And so, you know, one thing was just that, you know, we treat most of our food as if it's just, you know, sneakers, right, or a board game or something like that. So stocking, you know, the baking aisle at Christmas is no different from stocking the toy aisle, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I moved on to produce, I just really gained an appreciation for what a high-level skill that is to manage a produce section, right? Because if you think about it, you know, that means you have to, if you're good at your job, you're on top of, you know, 300 to 500 items that are rotting at different rates,
right,
and making sure that they all look good and they're all kept fresh and things like that. So I just really came to appreciate sort of how important that work is. And then because the produce department I was in was managed so poorly, I was also just sort of taken aback at how inefficient that seemed to be, for being at a company known for its efficiencies, that was very surprising.
But what was it like for the coworkers you met and for you experiencing it yourself to work at a Walmart, and for the folks who'd been there longer and were better at their job, you know, what was the community like at Walmart? What was it like making it on a wage from Walmart?
Right. Well, I mean, people just really prioritize time and convenience a lot in the food that they're making. And they're eating, you know. So, you know, I certainly saw some terrible food being eaten. So there was a guy I worked with on the night shift. So when I was doing the grocery stocking, I was on the night shift. And so everybody takes lunch at the same time at 2 in the morning. And, you know, I had this one colleague, and every night he'd be sitting there with a big bag of chips and a 2 liter of Mountain Dew and just drinking it straight out of the 2 liter. And I sort of said, oh, wow, like, why are you eating like that? He's like, it's cheap and it's easy.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting, right, because I think a lot of our discussions around food tend to be like, oh, people who don't have much money, they just don't care about what they're eating. You know, but he didn't say, this is what I want to be eating, and this is really tasty, and this is the best food I can eat. He was just like, this is cheap, and it's easy, and it's right here, and I can do it now, which really changed sort of how I thought about, you know, changing the American diet and the American way of eating, right, because we obviously have a big public health problem that's related to diet. And the more I talked to people, the more that I was like, oh, people eat fresh food and fruits and vegetables when it's easy. You know, we had free fruit Fridays when I worked on the day shift. And that stuff, you know, emptied out immediately. So there'd be these bins of fresh produce in the break room for everyone to take. Everyone eats that when that's easy. You know, it's just that, you know, as a general rule, eating healthfully just isn't that easy for most folks.
Well, it's easier to go to a fast food restaurant than it is to go to a little market, you know, your produce market, and then go to your meat market, and then go to the bread store, and then go to the cheese store. And, you know, some of the sensibilities that are even changing now in Europe, but we're, you know, in Paris, that's what you would do on your way home from work. You would stop in each of those stores and spend, you know, 5 or 10 minutes in each place and pick your meal for the evening and go and make your meal. And very few of us in this country operate that way. We buy 2 weeks' worth of groceries, we put them in the pantry, and then we figure out how we're going to eat from that, and you know, we take breaks with fast food.
Right. I mean, it's been really fascinating for me to have a life where my time and my money and my are just really, really constrained, because obviously I don't make much money as a writer, but my time is incredibly flexible. And so I usually can eat pretty well because I can decide to prioritize where to get my food from, or, you know, if I can make stock from scratch and things like that. I found that I really stopped liking cooking as soon as it became mandatory, because in most of my life, cooking is something that I could, if I didn't feel like it, I could opt to not do it, right? I could go get some takeout. I could, you know, run to a restaurant, something like that. I could pull something maybe out of the freezer. But I got to this point when I was working at Walmart on the night shift where I had, you know, made this decision about my grocery shopping, and I went and bought a bunch of stuff in bulk because it's a cheaper unit price. And then, you know, my budget kept going down and down and down. All of a sudden I realized, you know, I had sort of tied up all of my money in grain futures. So I had, like, oats, and I had wheat, and I had rice.
Right, grain futures in your cabinet, not
in my cabinet.
Yeah.
Right, and so I had, like, no money for rent, right? I was, like, $20 short on rent, but I had food.
So let's talk about, you discuss in your book in the beginning your own family's relationship with food, and you know, you had difficult circumstances growing up, and when you first moved to New York, there's this notion that you deal with that, you know, caring about your food is for the middle class and the wealthy. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah, so where I grew up, you know, taking your food seriously or caring about it was something that sort of, this caricature of a snooty, liberal, urban person would do. And, you know, my family's not that conservative, but, like, the idea was that if you were worried about what kind of lettuce you were eating, like, you were talking down to people. And interestingly enough, you know, like, I talk a bit in the book about my grandmother, and she will tell you, you know, like, she doesn't like fancy food, but she's an amazing home cook. And when we were growing up, you know, we would go to, you know, the Pontiac Farmers Market, which is, I mean, this is before Farmers Market were the thing that they are now. This was actually just, like, where the local farmers went to sell their stuff.
Right.
It wasn't set up to be a specific market or anything. It just sort of had, know, existed and we went for it. But at the same time, you know, people's time was really constrained. Our money was really constrained. And so during the week, you know, we ate a lot of Hamburger Helper and taco dinners and things like that. Not because we thought, oh, this is the best food ever, but because, you know, spending more time or energy on your food was this snooty thing.
Right.
And, you know, I feel like there's a bit of a cultural disconnect here, because I certainly, when I got to college, I had a scholarship to go to NYU. I started nannying for these really wealthy families, and I worked for a couple families who were very generous and kind, and that I would, you know, I would eat with them and cook for them sometimes, and all of a sudden, you know, I was being told to, like, make mesclun salad mix and, you know, oh, did you want to cook out the Mahir Jafri, like, Moroccan cookbook? Because maybe you could make some tagine and things like this, you know. And I said, well, I mean, I don't know if they're snobs or not, but this is really good. You know,
that's the whole, like, oh, I can't believe these snobby.
Kind of. And I said, well, this is, and I sort of felt like I'd been hoodwinked, you know, throughout my, like, growing up. Because I'm like, this food isn't, like, for, like, idiots. This is really good food, and why should any of this be something that I don't feel like I have access to, or that my family feels alienated by, or people sort of who want to change the way Americans eat, right, just talking down to folks instead of, you know, having a conversation with people about why they're making the decisions they're making, as opposed to just being like, that's the wrong decision about your meal, you should do it this way. You know, I found it much more powerful to have conversations with people about, you know, why they're choosing the meals they're choosing, and then trying to work with the logic that works for them.
What a topsy-turvy world. I mean, if you think about 80 years ago, what was the, you know, there was fancy food for rich people. It was caviar and foie gras and oysters, if you didn't live near oysters. But you know, the everyday food was, you know, what came out of your garden in the backyard or came from the local farmer. And that was everyday food. And now Pop-Tarts are everyday food, and that's considered fancy food by some. Like, oh, you're not going to change the way I eat. You're not going to make me not eat my McDonald's hamburger anymore.
Yeah, how dare you make me eat lettuce.
And that's somehow fancy food. But it's really it's a tremendous feat in marketing that we've turned the idea of, you know, fresh apples, fresh tomatoes, fresh lettuce, fresh carrots into some sort of a, you know, an elitist thing when it's the most basic thing of all.
Right. Well, and there's this sort of cultural through line with this that I just find really curious and strange, which is that, you know, being able to make a decision about whether or not to cook is a really basic piece of self-sufficiency, right? Like,
right.
In order to be take care of yourself and your family well, you got to be somewhat literate about food. So you can decide, you know, tonight it's worth it to go out and spend all that extra money, or I'm going to cook and eat this way. And there's been sort of a lot of ceding of authority to food marketers and big companies that are trying to sell us stuff and saying, oh, they know what's good for us, and we'll just pay attention to that instead of really knowing what's going on for ourselves. So, I mean, it's really interesting. In January, you know, Walmart announced a new label for its food, which is like a good-for-you label or better-for-you label, that it's going to affix to, you know, foods that are better for you. And the criteria are very simple. It's something like low salt, low sugar, and I think produce, right? They're actually going to put this sticker on fresh produce to say this is good for you. And, you know, it's great to make things easier for people to get good food, but part of me also feels like, shouldn't we make sure Americans can just make that decision for themselves, right? That, like, we already know fruits and vegetables are good for us, and
right.
You should know that a grapefruit's better for you
than
Pop-Tarts.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Tracy, that the book is tremendous, and the amount of work that you put into it is obvious, and I know that it's getting a lot of acclaim, and it's really, really well deserved. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for coming on our
Tracy.
Show.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me.
Tracy McMillan's book is called The American Way of Eating, undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. You can find out more about it at restaurantguysradio.com under this show. Stick with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. She's pretty smart, that lady.
Well, I think she really had an interesting way of looking at these topics. And, you know, a month isn't a long time to work in a Walmart. A month isn't a long time to work in an Applebee's. A month is a lifetime to be picking garlic.
A day. It wouldn't last a day.
And she talks about how in the book there were times when she was like, you know, I'm not sure that I can do this. But when you work and you labor and you watch the way some people in America labor, you just it really makes you realize, you know, what goes into putting the food on the table. And that, you know, one of the things you talked about earlier is maybe it would be better if tomatoes were $3 a pound all the time instead of $1.24.
You know,
at
that
Walmart.
We spend a third of what we used to spend as the middle class spends a third of what it used to spend as a result of income on food. And frankly, I think that the results of that are bad. Mm-hmm. And when you look at how, you know, obviously she worked in an inexpensive restaurant, she worked in a Walmart, and those are jobs that are hard. They're certainly hard. But working in the fields, man, I mean, that's
right.
Serfdom. And it's serfdom.
Well, working in the fields for a day in California in 100-degree heat for $19.
I
think it says it all.
And I think, you know, liberal or conservative, we have to bear in mind, you know, that there are certain things that are just, there's a level that's just not acceptable. There's a level that's not acceptable.
And you know what? It doesn't matter if you're liberal or conservative in this particular argument, because these are people who are working for a living. These are people who are working.
This is not the lazy
poor. Right.
This is
people working their tail off, and how you feel about welfare or you know, which side of the aisle you fall on there. Doesn't matter at all. You're talking about people working their tails off for $19 a day.
Well, and when you look at the free market, well, you know, if we don't pay that, you know, if mm-hmm. our you know, we're competing with the world market. Well, you know what? We shouldn't be buying our produce from places where in foreign countries.
Right.
People
Why are
have
we competing
like
with China for apples? You know, apples are grown in New York State, and we should.
And if the Chinese treat their workers like this,
right.
then we should have a tariff on the you know, I don't know. There needs to be a floor where we as a society say, no, you can't pay someone that little, and
acceptable.
You can't make people work that
You know,
hard.
And we see it in the clothing industry, and slowly we're seeing fair trade come into the food industry.
In many ways.
But, you know, just like you can't pay somebody in Malaysia 40 cents a day to make socks, you can't pay somebody, an immigrant worker, $19 a day to pick garlic.
Well,
you just can't.
And the sad part is, of course, you can do both of those things. but you shouldn't be. But maybe
right.
you shouldn't be able to. And you know what? If your groceries cost more in the supermarket, you know, would that be a horrible thing? I don't know. I don't think the cheapest is always best, you know.
Well, as long as you're making sure that there's a certain standard of living that people can achieve.
She raises a lot of questions. It's a beautiful, beautifully written book, and it's really insightful, and it's not judgmental. I don't agree with everything she says in the book either, but it's really worth looking at. It's a lot of work that went into looking at this problem from a whole new perspective, and I suggest you pick it up. Hope you've enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We're the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.